Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Savage Nation, and back with you live is myself, yours truly, Michael Savage, playing a little Blue Monday, even though it's Tuesday, because it feels like Monday to me. I don't know about you. It's actually a very good day. I mean, the fact is, there's some great news out there, and I'm going to do the news. Believe me, it's all about news. This is news talk at the end of the day. Newsweek is out of business that was sold for a dollar to a man who owns a stereo company. My headline is Sound Man Buys Deaf Newsweek, WEAK, for a dollar. But the bigger news is that the California Supreme Court has rejected affirmative action. I headlined it as The Judges Save the People. And that's a big, big story. It didn't make it to the national news because the national news, which is going out of business, doesn't want you to know that there's been a fundamental shift in this country away from the radical liberalism that gave us radical Obama. Radical Obama is yesterday's news. Radical Obama is to the left of Fidel Castro. It's amazing to me that as Castro says he's moving away from the public sector and trying to sort of privatize Cuba, this character from Chicago's colleges and streets is trying to do what Castro is running away from. Everything that Europe tried and rejected, he's introducing here, like he just discovered it, him and his idiotic cronies from Harvard and Yale. But I'm not going to get worked up. I've been off for almost a week with a minor or whatever I had. I'm not going to go into details. But one of the beautiful things about having been sort of sick is that I went down a pant size, went out shopping over the weekend, bought new pants that were a size smaller. It's a beautiful, but there's no better weight loss diet than a radical illness that almost kills you for a week. When you're sick for a week and you don't want to eat. It's amazing how you look. Everyone says you look great when you're almost, like in your mind, you're almost dead. They say you look great. What is this obsession in America with thinness? I ran into a heavyset woman in one of the Italian restaurants I like in the city. Nice lady, an Italian lady in a hole-in-the-wall place that I love. So she's, oh, you look terrific. I said, yeah, I was sick for a week. I didn't eat. She said, oh, look at me. I said, where is it written in the Bible that it's a crime to be fat? What are you talking about? Where is there a something in the Bible that says it's actually a moral sin to be heavy? I see morality mentioned in the Bible in other areas that people don't seem to pay much attention to, but being overweight doesn't seem to be one of the moral negatives in the Bible. So she smiled at that. But that's the truth. Everyone is obsessed with being thin, thin, thin. It's a cultural phenomenon. My prediction is soon we're going to want to look like those in Pickwickian England, the type of old gentleman who would fall asleep in the club in those eras that are long gone. California Supreme Court rejects affirmative action. That is the big story. Again, the California Supreme Court, which is very moderate, very, very moderate, has ruled against the city of San Francisco and has said that affirmative action must end again in California. They ruled that Proposition 209, which was passed by the voters to end racial preferences in California, it means that Gavin Newsom and his far-left cronies must now stop discriminating against white male contractors. It seems that the moderate judges of California have saved this state from its own far-left politicians. Now, this is a huge loss for Attorney General Jerry Brown, Moonbeam Brown, who is again trying to worm his way back into the governor's mansion after 30 years on the outside. Brown had endorsed San Francisco's argument that white males should be discriminated against. Now, anyone who thinks that Jerry Brown has become more conservative or that Jerry Brown has turned over a new leaf should know that he went against the will of the people of California to support out-and-out racism against white males in this case. Brown wanted to nullify the votes of millions. But even more important, is the fact that the moderate judges of the California state have for the second time saved the state from his so-called leaders. When Gavin Newsom tried to declare gay marriage legal, the California Supreme Court struck that down as well. And when the people of California reinforced that ruling by voting for Prop 8, which banned gay marriage, well, the judges said, good for you. Now, for the first time in ages, I am proud to report the courts and the people seem to be on the same side. On the other side are Jerry Brown, Gavin Newsom, Barack Obama, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, and all the other political hustlers who exploit race and sexual orientation for their own gain. This is Michael Savage. Now, I don't want to talk about affirmative action. There's another story that's up there. And my headline on Michael Savage is Anchor Babies Away, A-W-E-I-G-H, for those of you who are nautically inclined. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, I call him the gobbler. I call Mitch McConnell affectionately the gobbler. The gobbler said Congress ought to take a look at changing the 14th Amendment, which gives the children of illegal immigrants a right to U.S. citizenship. They're called anchor babies because many of their parents come across the border in the ninth month of pregnancy to drop the baby on our doorstep so they have an anchor in the United States of America, which is why we're going broke and why our culture has been melted down. And so, yeah, the Republicans are saying they ought to take a look, which means they're not going to do it. It's just a bone that they're throwing to the conservative electorate until they get reelected so they can go back and do business as usual, which is shafting the populace all over again. Here's another story from the New York Post, this one. Two Muslims convicted for a plot to blow up JFK fuel tanks at the same time that Mayor Bloomberg, in his infinite stupidity, is in favor of the Ground Zero Mosque. That's right. Abdul Qadir, a pistol-packing Shiite convert, were found guilty of plotting one of the most chilling plots imaginable, blowing up fuel tanks at JFK, hoping to set off a greater conflagration than that of 9/11. Both of them are Muslim. Now, you may say, well, what does that have to do with the fact of the story? I'll let you put two and two together. That's all. You figure it out. Now, another story I want to talk about is Newsweek and how it was sold for a dollar to the audio tycoon Sidney Harman. Many of you have used the Harman Kardon stereophonic devices. I don't have one myself. I use Bose, neither of whom advertise on my show. But Harman Kardon designed some beautiful audio equipment over his career, or at least he was the man who owned the company that designed some beautiful equipment. And he's 91 years old. His wife is Jane Harman. Jane Harman is one of the radical leftists in Congress, a Dem, of course, a former mayor of San Diego who bought her way into Congress, who is now sitting on the House Security Committee, whatever they call it. Here is a housewife, Jane Harman, a radical left-wing housewife from San Diego. I believe she is the chairman of the House Subcommittee on Intelligence. This is what's running America today in a war on terror, if you can believe it. Anyway, her old man, Sidney, just bought Newsweek for a buck. Now you say, how could that be? Newsweek, that's a venerable institution. National treasure. Well, is it a national treasure when it puts out liberal tripe every week? It had to reduce the liberal tripe to once a month until it went out of business. We looked up the actual circulation of this Newsweek, and you'll see why he paid a dollar for it. And I'll tell you why it's more than a dollar and why he bought it. Take a guess what the circulation is of Newsweek magazine. Look, when you were younger, 30 years ago, Newsweek was something most people read. But now, not anymore. Their circulation is down to about 62,000 copies per edition. I think it's, what, once a week now or once a month? Does anyone know? It's weekly. It's still weekly because I know they had to change it a little bit. Okay, so their circulation of Newsweek, the circulation of Newsweek is 62,000 a week. My audience is 8 to 10 million a week. What did I just say? Newsweek, 62,000 a week. Savage Nation, 8 to 10 million a week. Good Housekeeping, down to 395,000 a week. Red Book, down to 126,000 a week. Time Magazine, that despicable left-wing rag, 90,000 idiots read it a week. So why is talk radio still a giant in the news business while these news weeklies are falling by the wayside is the question. And I would throw a question to my audience as follows. When did you stop reading news weeklies and why did you stop reading them? Now, I know you'll probably call with the obvious because they were too biased to the left, which they are. We all know that. They're all twisted to the left and people don't want the anti-American, anti-military. anti-police, anti-family, anti-church, anti-family, anti-children magazines in their home. It's like pornography. These left-wing weeklies are like having porno in the house. People today would rather have internet pornography fed into their house than have Newsweek or Time. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Extra, extra, hear all about it. Newsweek goes down to tubes for a dollar. Michael Savage, 62,000 people a week read Newsweek. 8 to 10 million listen to me. They exist and I don't exist, right? It's a world through the looking glass. Newsweek, Time, you name it. It's a world through a looking glass. And they pass the looking glass back and forth to each other. And they say, look how the world looks, Harold. Oh, Marvin, look at the world that we see. But nobody wants to buy into that imagery. I got to tell you something. I'm glad to be back. I was down, but not for the count. I went down for about a three count, and I'm back. I didn't know. I'm not going to go into it with the sympathy number. I'm not the guy with the goggles on the nose with the blackboard. I got to tell you, though, I really didn't know for 3 days. I didn't know what was going on. I thought I was really sick. And I said, this could be God. It is with the God that. But it wasn't. It was a temporary thing. And I swear it's like a new lease on life the way I feel when I feel. I have such energy right now to talk with you. I love being with you. I love talking with you. I love talk radio. I love the business that I'm in. I love the fact that we're the last link between you and the abyss. If it wasn't for talk radio and the internet, we would be in the abyss of communism. Because as sure as I'm sitting here, Obama and his cronies want to drag us into a world that the Chinese and the Russians left behind. As sure as I'm sitting here, that's where they want to go. These are far left dangerous ideologues, but I'm not going to waste my time telling you what you already know, because you've heard it enough times to know it's true. So let's focus on the media that put this imposter in the White House. Newsweek, Time, you name it. They told you, they sold you a bill of goods. He was a genius. He was a messiah. He was the man who was going to save America and bring us together. He drove us apart. He's almost created a second civil war in the country with his deviousness and his contempt for people. So here we are. You know, last night I was in a local restaurant. I went in. There was a young lady who was the hostess, if you want to say that, whatever they call. I don't know. The names, everything changes what they call today. I don't know. Maitre d'. So she said, oh, I haven't seen her there. You know, I hadn't seen it. So she sits me down. She says, I just want to tell you, my father is a big fan of yours. I said, oh, that's so nice. Particularly in a liberal county where I live. They let an actual, you know, human being in there. She said, my father loves your show. So I said, great. She said, you know what my father likes most about your show? I said, I don't know. She said, one of the things he loves most is when you talk about Teddy. I don't understand it, but Teddy seems to have touched a chord in America. I don't know what it is. Me and the dog, his mask. You know, like the old RCA Victor thing with the gramophone and the dog, Spot listening to the gramophone, his master's voice. Great image. That's Teddy sleeping under the desk right now. I can't even put my feet under my desk. For fear I'll step on his pads. There he is. Okay, I got it behind his tail. If anyone comes near my desk during a show, he tries to snap at their feet. This is a calm dog. Let an engineer come near a computer under my desk during a show. He goes for their finger. He doesn't bark. He doesn't say he's like a silent killer. He's like a shark. He comes right, you know, not even a bark. Just goes right, snap. He protects me. That's their job. They don't have a job. You got to understand something. Dogs are like household bums or hippies. A dog is our atavistic self. This is why we love them so. Everyone has a dog understands that basically they're a hippie. Or a homeless person or a hobo. But a nice, kind, homeless person living with you who only wants to help you. And at least they do something for you, unlike a homeless person, which is generally a leech. At least a dog gives you something, whether it be protection or kindness. But that's their whole job, is to protect you. You're in bed, so you got a little one. You have 16 of them like the ancient Chinese did. You have 16 yappers go at an assassin. The assassin gets chopped to ribbons. And by the time the assassin knows which way the dogs are came at them, the guard comes in and kills the assassin. That's where the Lhasa Apsus came from. The princess would sleep in her silken bed, and she had 16 Lhasa Apsus, or whatever they were called, in the bed with her, the temple dogs. You know, I once met a guy on an airplane. I'm getting distracted here. I asked you about Newsweeklies. I got to tell you a long story about something that's not that important, but it was interesting. I remember I was flying to London, and I'm still having the nightmare, by the way, that I'm trapped in London at Heathrow and I can't get out. I missed the plane. The plane was canceled. Plane is full. Can't get on. Stuck in London. It's, again, the same obsession. But I had this for 2 years prior to being banned in Britain, which means I had precognitive volition of what was going to happen. I had an idea this was coming inside me, but I didn't know it. It was precognitive recognition of what was coming. It was written about by many people. That, I mean, precognitive recognition is written about. It's a whole factual episode inside the human mind where you have a sense something's coming through your subconscious. Anywho, or anyhow, whatever. Where was I? Again, starting with the distraction again. Where was I going, Beowulf? For too long. Oh, so years ago, in the 80s, I flew to London on the way to Israel. I was on the way to London and Israel to collect plants. I was a plant collector, not buying factories like the Chinese. Botanical collector. Because if I say plant collector, you think I'm one of the Chinese who bought all of the industrial plants under Bill Clinton, who sold our industrial base to the Chinese. No, I was a botanical collector, first to London to look at my collections at Kew Gardens, then on to Israel to investigate the healing plants that were known by the Arab communities in the West Bank. Believe it or not, it was crazy work. Believe it or not, yeah, I did some of that. That's right. Was still able to do it. Admittedly, I went with Arab guides, but I went into the West Bank, and the folks were still using folk medicine, and no one cut my throat, you know what I'm saying? So I'm on this long flight from San Francisco to London, a 10-hour flight. I'm in coach, but in those days, the planes were mostly empty. I can't believe what happened. The whole coach section, you'd get a row to yourself. I'm pacing. I'm a pacer. So 3 hours into the flight, I already had the meal. I had the nap, and I'm marching in the middle of the night. And a guy comes up to me, starts marching with me, starts to talk. And one word leads to another. I think he was jacked out of his mind on coke, the way he couldn't stop talking, this guy. And he said to me, he was a cocaine dealer. I said, what? I really didn't want to know anymore. He said, no, I'm not going to. He told me, I don't know if he was lying or what, but he told me the most dangerous. Well, I'll tell you when I come back.
Savage.
Welcome back to the dog days of August. It's August at the Hotel Ozone or the Hotel Savage. I remember in the 60s there was a left wing. Well, left. It was kind of an offbeat movie called the, August Days of the Hotel Ozone. Beautiful movie, crazy. But as you well know, the Romans referred to the dog days as Dix Canicularix, and they associated the hot weather with the star Sirius. They considered Sirius to be the dog star because it is the brightest star in the constellation Canis Major. Large dog. Sirius is also the brightest star in the heavens besides the sun. Now, the term dog days was used earlier by the Greeks. They really did everything. See, especially Aristotle's Physics. Originally, the dog, oh, who cares? You know what it means. Because the Romans sacrificed a brown dog at the beginning of the dog days to appease the rage of Sirius, believing that the star was the cause of the hot, sultry weather. What did they know? Dog days, by the way, before I finish this, were popularly believed to be an evil time when the seas boiled, wine turned sour, dogs grew mad, and all creatures became languid, causing man burning fevers, hysterics, and frenzies. Now, of course, that still applies to Al Gore and his global warming maniacs. That is when, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that, absolutely. Man gets burning fevers, in this case, sexual fevers, hysterics, that would be the and frenzies, no doubt. So let me get back to the story I started to tell you, then get back to the news if I don't get distracted again. So I'm on this plane 15, 20 years ago going to London. Long flight. I have nothing to do. I'm walking. Dark, middle of the night. When you're flying over the pole, I used to love seeing the aurora. What was up there? The stars up there are awesome at night. You know, in those days, you could walk around a plane at night and have a drink. No one bothered you. Today, they strap you in a chair, and they call 911. So I'm walking around. This guy comes up, and he's talking my head off. Tells me he's a drug dealer. I said, okay, really don't want to know anymore. But he was actually a friendly guy. I don't know if he was bull-crapping me or whatever. So he says to me, what do you think is the best home defense? So I said, I don't know. I would think that a loaded gun and a shotgun and a dog. He said, well, I go for the gun and the shotgun. But he said, no, you're wrong. He said, many small dogs are better than a large dog. I said, why? I asked the masked man. He said, because an intruder can shoot a big dog even in the dark. It has a large profile, big profile. But it's very difficult, he said, to shoot many small dogs coming at you from all sides at once. Now, if you want to order a small dog, you cannot call 1-800-SMALL-DOG and enter my code SAVAGE to get a free bone. But that's the story. Now, I'm not telling you to go out and buy small dogs, but I know that's what he said. What can I tell you? So now we go back to the news. So Newsweek is bought for a dollar by Harman, the 91-year-old audio tycoon of Harman Kardon, whose wife, as I say, is the mad liberal Jane Harman. And he pays a dollar. But he also assumes all liabilities for Newsweek. Now, what are the liabilities? Oh, they're amazing. Revenue dropped 38% between 07 and 09 to $165 million. Say, well, that's a lot of money, right? Yeah, but take a look at what the negligible operating loss is. Pensions, early retirement, right? The business lost $32 million in 08 and lost $40 million in 09. Now, even after they reduced the headcount by 33% and slashed the number of issues printed to readers each week from 2.6 million to 1.5 million, the 2010 operating loss for Newsweek is still forecast at $20 million. They're going to lose $20 million, right? The guy still buys it. But listen to this. It gets worse. The numbers get even worse. Newsweek lost money in all three of its core areas in 08 and 09. That is in U.S. publishing, foreign publishing, and digital. So nothing has saved them. And even with the smaller guaranteed circulation, it still retains $40 million in subscription liabilities owed to some readers. And then, listen to this. Last year, this magazine paid $13 million in rent, a phenomenal figure for a company this size. So in steps Sidney Harman, 91 years old, who says he read the first issue of Newsweek back in 1933. And he said his goal was not to make a profit anytime soon, but rather to reach break even by 2013. Well, people say even the billionaire founder of Harman Kardon and Harman International Industries will absolutely not be able to make this thing work. But he didn't really buy it to make it work. He bought it, in my opinion, as a hobby horse and also to push the left-wing agenda that all of these liberals are known for. I do not believe that this man really cares if he makes any money. It's a good way to lose money and have people kiss your butt. 1-800-449-8255. I only hope that I'll wake up one day and see Time magazine is next to go. That magazine has done more damage to America than, I would say, CNN and MSNBC put together. No question about it. So I throw it back to you. Do you read Newsweeklies? When did you stop reading Newsweeklies? Why did you stop reading Newsweeklies? This is the Savage Nation. I don't know who to begin with. Let's start with Maureen in New York. Maureen, welcome to the Savage Nation from WOR. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mike. I just want to say, where are the people of New York City? Where are all the firemen? Where are all the sanitation? Where are all those people that were involved, the thousands and thousands? Where are they? Why are they not protesting on the streets? I know they can't get into the meetings because it's too small.
Maureen, what subject are we talking about now?
I'm talking about 9/11, and I'm talking about putting the mosque down on the sacred ground.
Well, I am sad to tell you the reason you don't see any protests is because there's so much money at stake in the mosque building that you're going to see only those who are making money off it having anything to say. There's nothing in it for the protesters. They don't have any principles. What do you think, people really care about anything?
The money.
All right, I don't want to eat my heart out. That's all. Leave me alone. I'm sorry. I'm not going to eat my heart out today. I won't do it. I had already my guts eaten out last week. I don't need another organ eaten out. The guts already I had eaten out, they grew back. They're like a planarial worm. I regrew my intestines from last week. I don't want to make light of it, but please leave me alone with the mosque already. The money lined up. Mayor Bloomberg, in his infinite stupidity. Mayor Bloomberg is an infinite stupidity. Every time you hear, well, we're doing this to prove what kind of nation we are. That the reason the men are dying in Iraq and Afghanistan is to make sure that Muslims can build mosques in America. You putz, you. That's not why. It's because there's a rake-off job. You know it and I know it. You know, there's plenty of vig go right up to the top, Bubba. Don't think we're all that stupid. Chicago, Herb, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, I want to say I'm a retired Chicago police officer. I stopped reading Newsweek approximately 30 years ago.
Wow.
After they became so anti-police and so left-wing, I couldn't stand the issue coming to my house.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yes, they targeted the police first. That's because the left wing decided that the thin blue line was too thick. They wanted a zero blue line so that we could have all of the violent criminals taking over the streets. Because the left wing is insane. You know that, Herb.
I know one thing. You are the only thing that is standing out between anarchy and this madness that is going on with this government.
Well, I'm not the only one. During this time slot, I'm the only one. There are others trying to do a good job, and I'd say 20% of the time they do it. Herb, let me ask you something. You're out of the business of being a policeman for how long?
9 years.
And how does it feel not working as a street? Were you on the streets?
Wonderful. I worked the streets my entire life.
And was it tough? Tougher toward the end, I would guess?
It's tough because the politicians make it tough.
You mean if you just were able to do your job as a cop with a nightstick and a gun, you could have done your job, in other words?
Exactly. The politicians make the job tough.
So whatever you did, they were looking over your shoulder and calling you every name under the sun. So they made you gun shy, in other words, if you're of your own gun.
It's worse now, Michael. It's worse.
I don't know how anyone is a cop today. I just don't know it. I have a family member in the police business. I get some of the stories of the left-wing vermin looking over their shoulder. But it's why the criminals are empowered today, Herb. The reason they're bold and the reason they take the shots that they do is they know they're going to be protected by the vermin on the left. You know that.
Well, it makes one get out of that business, and thank God I have two sons, and they never chose to go into law enforcement.
Well, but here's the problem. It's like everything else. So who's going into it? That's the problem that we have. All right, Herb, thanks. Appreciate it. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I guess the topic today is, when did you stop reading a Newsweekly and why? I mean, we'll do that for a little while, but I don't want to lose all of the other stories on my website, Michael Savage. Illegal alien who killed nun in accident was released by feds. You talk about a crazy story? Carlos Montano, you see, had been arrested two other times on drunken driving charges. Now, I know we're supposed to say they all come here to work, but some come here to drive drunk because the laws are so much weaker here than they are in Mexico that it's actually a danger. So the guy's arrested twice on drunken driving charges. He's an illegal alien. And on one of those occasions, county police reported the illegal alien to federal authorities who refused to prosecute. Then when he was prosecuted, he was released by feds, and now he killed a nun. If you want to make an omelet, you got to. New York City panel clears way for mosque near Ground Zero. The move was applauded by the New York Civil Liberties Union and the despicable anti-American ACLU, which of course takes the side of radical Muslims at every turn. They cited principles of religious freedom, which they fight against with every fiber in their twisted, fetid beings. The very same stinkos in the ACLU who hate God, who hate the church, who hate the cross in particular, who sneer at religious people, wrap themselves in the principles of religious freedom to argue for the construction of a mosque at Ground Zero. That's the world we live in. The enemy within. The enemy within. The enemy within. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Bruce, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I remember
exactly
when I quit reading Newsweek. A year ago, January, they started a new column called Brain Teasers, and their first brain teaser was how many presidents obtained the rank of general before being president. And their answer was three: Washington, Eisenhower, and Grant. And of course the answer is 11. They forgot Jackson. They forgot Tippecanoe and Tyler II. They forgot Scott. They've got all sorts of guys who were all generals. And I had to ask myself, what is their reason for misstating this? And the answer, of course, is, you don't have to have any military experience.
That's right. In other words, we knew we were getting an inexperienced imposter in the White House who never served in the military, who is anti-military, anti-police, anti-flag, anti-family, you name it. And so they say, well, patriotism doesn't really matter. Look at that. Only three guys were generals before they were presidents. And so we could have a general of the Marxist army in the White House. It's just as good.
Magazine does not fact check something as easy as finding out how many presidents were generals. I got my answer just by looking at the White House official biographies.
But you see, you're a thoughtful man who probably went to high school 20 years ago or more. Is that correct?
30 years ago or more.
30 years ago. So a high school degree of 30 years ago is the equivalent of an average baccalaureate degree today. The baccalaureate degree today is maybe a general diploma in high school in my day. It has almost no meaning whatsoever because they've watered it down so much to accommodate people who, frankly, do not deserve to be in college. It's just a holding tank to keep them out of the workforce so they're not in the streets mugging people. So instead they put them into college to fill up the chairs. I think we've covered the waterfront on that. Let's see if there's anything else I got for you here. I'll take a few more on that. Let us listen to some of the sound. Here is President Barack Hussein Obama, as you well know, the president of the world, who is temporarily sitting in his seat here in the Oval Office. He gave a speech today yesterday, in clip one.
And whether you like it or not, this really ends up being a referendum on you. If you had to give yourself an assessment for these first 18 months, how would you grade yourself?
It's incomplete because until the economy has rebounded fully and people are feeling better, we've got a long way to go.
Really? We've got a long way to go. So now he's giving himself an incomplete, an I after a year and a half. That's interesting. Now, here's a man on the street reaction to the mosque ruling in New York City in clip five.
Now, building a mosque right on top of it is hurtful, and religion shouldn't be hurtful. And if you want to build a relationship, do it in a way that's a little more, this is almost like a penetrative act. That's how severe this is.
Penetrative act? Well, of course, that's New York City, where they speak in such ribald terms, or ribald, depending upon which kind of drink you prefer. Rye or ree. I'll be right back.
Savage.
The fact is that we have found since 9/11, a number of imams and Muslim leaders are not cooperating with law enforcement. Secondly, I remember the outrage at Auschwitz when Catholic nuns wanted to put up a convent near Auschwitz. And I'm saying, in many ways, this is the same, that you have sacred ground and you have a mosque being put up there when there's any number of other locations in the city. And that's why even such a liberal-minded group as the Anti-Defamation League has also come out against this. And that, to me, speaks volumes.
Right. Why do the radical Muslims want to put a mosque up on the ashes of 9/11? Is that not an act of a victory dance? In some way, isn't it spite? Now, if there's an outcry over it, you could say, well, you know, even if we didn't intend it to be antagonistic, it has become antagonistic. And for the sake of peace between Muslims and others, we understand that there are sensibilities about this, so we're going to move it. We're going to put it somewhere else. But why do they want it there so badly? There's no reason for it to have to be there, you know? So listen to the rest of Rep. Peter King, 7 and 8, back-to-back.
Well, surely, listen, they have freedom to put the mosque anywhere they want. I'm just saying it should not be near ground zero in view of the sensitivity, in view of the history, and the fact that it's looked upon as almost sacrilegious by people who lost their friends, neighbors, relatives at ground zero in the murders of 9/11. As far as Islam being a religion of peace, the fact is that it was Muslims who carried out the attack on 9/11, and people feel the sensitivity to have it there, just as people in Poland resented the Catholic nuns' convent being near Auschwitz.
That's Rep. Peter King commenting on New York City landmark panel's approval of a mosque to be built near Ground Zero. I guess if you want to chime in on that, you can call the Savage Nation. I doubt a few people listening to this show would think it's a great idea to build a mosque near Ground Zero, but I could be wrong. I'm sure many of you want to say it's a mark of our pluralistic society, it's a mark of multiculturalism, it's a way to show the moderate Muslims that we love them. I know you could come up with all of that But if there are so many people who are offended by it, why do you have to have it there other than to offend them? Why? Why do you have to, like, throw salt in the wound? That's the whole point. If you're antagonizing so many people, why would you pick the site of 9/11? Why? Why do you have to pick Ground Zero? Why? Why can't you put it in Staten Island or in Brooklyn or in Queens or somewhere else in Manhattan? Let's say somewhere else in Manhattan. You must have it. You want a cultural center? Put it near the 96th Street, 92nd Street. Why? Put it uptown where all the libs go anyway. They can go from the Y to the mosque. If you want to have a liberal cultural center, which they say is like the 92nd Street Y where fake poets read and failed novelists read and menopausal women go to meet menopausal men, go ahead. So build one next to the 92nd Street Y where they could sit there chatting with each other. Not, there's no harm in it. No harm in it. Why do you have to build it down there? I mean, that's common sense. Jerry in New York on WOR on the topic of the Newsweeklies. Do you still read them?
No, greetings, Michael. About 4 months ago, I canceled. I had it for my office. I own a small business here. And I used to read it at lunchtime. Just I like to see what the other side's thinking. But it got to the point where my blood would boil. I'd see Barack's picture on the cover and Michelle, and they were all airbrushed and angelic.
Yes.
And I said, you know something, I've just got to do something. It got to the point where I wasn't even leaving it for other people. I'd take it home with me so I could read what was going on from that perspective. And I decided I needed to cancel it. I also canceled the Times from being delivered to my home. You know, I know what they're thinking. I've had
yes,
enough.
Exactly. You can predict every statement that they're going to make and every story that they write. You understand the beginning, the middle, and the end. Each one has a predestined plot line, which is that America no good, police bad, family worse, and church even worse.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Savage Nation, welcome back to the program, whatever. We've been talking about this and that, how the California Supreme Court last night rejected affirmative action. Moonbeam Brown, who wants to be governor again, tried to reinstate preferences in hiring for less qualified minorities and less qualified women in order to shaft white males, in plain English. You know, I don't mince words. And what's interesting is that the Supreme Court of the state of California said no to Jerry Brown. And no, you can't do it because it's a violation of the U.S. Constitution. It's a violation of Prop 209. And you're wrong, Jerry Brown. Now, the real question is, where does Meg Whitman stand on these things? I'm not a big Meg Whitman fan. Frankly, I'll probably sit it out right till the end. Jerry Brown, I know what to expect from. I know he's a far-left radical who's sort of repositioned himself as a moderate, but he isn't. If you actually look at his voting record, he's a far-left radical. He always has been. Whitman has presented herself as a fiscal conservative. Since she built a business, we'd have to assume she knows what it is to run a business. On the other hand, she's a social liberal. It's the best you're going to get in California today from the political class. She threw $90 million of her own money into the race already to just show you what to expect. There's no point in talking about that. 1-800-449-8255. We're talking about the Ground Zero Mosque. We're talking about why Newsweek was sold for a dollar. We're talking about the death of the weekly magazines, the news magazines, why nobody really reads them, excuse me, anymore. I mean, you find them in a doctor's office or a dental office. You go in for, let's say, a proctology exam, and before you go into the proctologist, you read Newsweek, because it's sort of about the same thing as getting a proctology exam. It kind of warms you up for the proctologist, in other words, to read Newsweek or Time. You get ready for what's to follow. What's to follow? I mean, they do have a role to play when you think about it. If you're in a waiting room and you're waiting to see a proctologist, right, what better than to read left-wing drivel? You know what you're going to get soon in the room there. This you get without anesthesia, so it gives you a little... It toughens you up for what's coming on the inside there. New York City WOR, Anthony, the mosque story. Go ahead, please.
Michael, hi. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I'm a New York City firefighter, and I know what it's all about down there. It's a real slap in the face to myself and other people involved with that sacred ground, what they plan on doing with it. Our local politicians, the state politicians, everybody just thinks they're doing the right thing. These people who voted to let this mosque go through today. I don't know how these people sleep with themselves at night. And it's amazing to me that this is happening in this country. And I don't know.
Well, you say you don't know how those people sleep with themselves at night. You answered your own question. They sleep with themselves at night.
It's a real sad thing to have to experience.
How does Mayor Bloomberg, who is of Jewish descent, not understand what he is doing here by backing this mosque, all in the name of freedom of religion? This has nothing to do with freedom of religion, does it?
Not in my eyes, it does not.
This is the freedom to insult the memories of those who died on 9/11.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's all. Let's move it on. What else do we have for you in the kitty here? How about some personal stories since I was gone for a week? Did you miss me while I was gone? How was your life? How was your life while Michael Savage was off the air? I think that'd be more interesting than this, frankly, right now. Did you have a Michael Savage withdrawal? Was life better or worse without me on the air? Did you tune in just to see if I was still alive or if I was coming back? How did you feel when you found there was a fill-in? Don't tell me what the fill-ins were. I'm not here to bash anybody. They do as good a job as anyone could do sitting in for me. You know, I am uniquely me, and people do the best they can in their own way. And I wouldn't have these people on if I didn't think that they were good enough for the job, but that's not the point. No fill-in is ever going to satisfy an audience who's gotten used to a guy who's been on the air. It's not 16 years. It's longer already. I did the math the other day. I almost fainted. Don't look back. You turn to a pillar of salt. 94 to 10 is already, what? Yeah, 16. 16, sweet 16. Sweet 16. Most men would have retired already. It was my fifth profession, radio. You realize that most guys would have already, they'd be on retirement. I considered it. I considered it. And I reconsidered it last week. But I've come back from that cave, and I'm not leaving anything. I'm not leaving radio. I don't want to leave radio. I'm staying here. I'm in for the fight. Because the world is a pretty empty place without a meaning, I got to tell you. And for me, I can't just go to Europe and get drunk in the afternoon and talk about what I ate in Provence. I mean, it's not my thing. You know, go on a cruise. How was the food? Oh, I don't know. Oh, you got to see what I ate. Veal cordon schmuck. You know what I mean? Big deal. And how was the wine? Oh, I drank wine. Hey, you drank wine, so you got a gas on you. Big deal. And fell asleep in your bed. All right. If you have not done it, God bless you. I did it all in my 30s when my children were young. I used to travel around as a lecturer on ships after I got my doctorate. And I did a lot of traveling in the South Seas on great cruise lines. I loved it. My bar bill was bigger than what I earned today. No, it was a... I actually looked in a trunk where I have mementos. I had some bar bill. It was not free. Okay, yeah, we got two first-class cabins, one for me and Mrs. S. and one for the children. First class, blah, blah, blah. And the meals were free, but we had to pay our wine bill. It was enormous. In those days, I drank a lot of wine. It was a big bill. Very, very big bill. That way, I enjoyed the trip more because it can get pretty, you know. But even on a cruise, I was working. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? I would give a lecture 3-4 nights of the week. I had something to do. Otherwise, I'd go nuts. The best cruise I was ever on, now that I think about cruising... I'm not talking about Broadway and East 10th Street. Now that I'm thinking about cruising, the best cruise I was on a Royal Viking ship. I don't remember the year, in the 80s sometime, and there was a group of World War II pilots. And these guys were going back to the South Seas Islands that they had flown missions in. What were they, in their 80s at the time? I don't really know. 70s, they looked very old. You know, I was much younger, what, 20 years ago, so they must have been 80s. The war was in the 40s, so they were 40 plus, 20. They were 60, 65. They looked 80 to me. But these were vigorous men. Anyone who was a pilot was vigorous to begin with, and if they survived, they were even more. Anyway, very nice guys, terrific guys. So as we'd go through the South Pacific, I'd sit with them and have drinks, and we would talk about their missions aboard ships. And one of them told me how on one of the, they'd be in a convoy of warships. So they were in a typhoon off the Solomon Islands, I believe. And one of the ships hit a wave that threw a sailor off. He told me, threw a sailor off the stern of the ship. As the ship went up, it threw him off in the water. And he swore to me that the next ship was driven into the water so low that the sailor who was thrown into the water wound up on the deck of the following ship. Now, I don't know whether it was a sea story. I could imagine it happened. Everything happened in war. Everything your mind could imagine happened in a war like World War II. You go back to World War I, do you know that? I think I read the numbers the other day. I didn't know. My mind was boggled. I read that. Is the number correct? I read that 3 million Englishmen died in World War I. 3 million Englishmen died in World War I, which is why the girls are all so horny today. I mean, why the women are so frustrated in England today. Because there was a heck of a stock lost in World War I. The same in Germany. They lost millions of people for what? For what? The cream of the country was lost. Anyway, here we are today. So I enjoyed that cruise. Nice guys, terrific guys. Joe in New York, welcome to the show. Welcome to the Savage Nation. So how was it without me?
Hey, Mike, I tell you, when you're not on the air, you know, I'm disappointed, so I'll turn the TV on and I'll take a listen to what the left's talking about, quickly get disgusted. And I'll crack a beer and I'll start cooking some Italian or something just to get my mind off politics for the night. I take a break from it.
So when I'm on the air, though, you want politics, I assume.
When you're on the air, I enjoy it so much, Mike. You know, it just prepares me for what's coming as far as this progressive culture just taking the country over the cliff. And I
yes, exactly. Well, in other words, the way I present the stories of the day matches, let's say, your worldview.
It does. It really does. And it helps in so many ways because your approach to politics, you know, if I take that template that you make for the politics for the country and I apply it to my small world, where I reside, it fits and it gives me direction.
Right. And anytime, here's something to take home, Joe. I've said it before, but it's important to say again. Whenever you wind up shaking your head saying, how did the judge do that? How did Mayor Bloomberg do this? Why did Obama do this? And there's no answer. There is an answer. The answer is always the same. Answer, because liberalism is a mental disorder. Does that fit for you, Joe?
Yeah, it sure does, Mike. It makes a whole lot of sense.
Well, of course, when you're making a meatball, you can understand what the country's been turned into in this country. That's my old joke. When America was great in the 50s, the meatballs were big and fluffy and tasty. And the more we've been pushed down the socialist path, the meatballs have become small and mean. Isn't that correct?
You're absolutely right, Mike.
They're like Swedish meatballs today because they're socialist meatballs. They're like the kind of meatballs you used to get like in a hotel in a chafing dish that you take one bite and you'd like spat it out in a napkin and like hide it in the garbage can on the way out. You wouldn't even eat it. And you couldn't take it home because it was filled with such horrendous sauce it would give your dog diarrhea. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is 50 degrees hotter in Florida than it is in San Francisco. The heat index is 50 degrees higher. Now, many people on the East Coast, you know, assume that there's global warming because you're having a very hot August. But here in California, Northern California, we've had one of the coolest summers on record. And you know, the old Mark Twain quip, I've never spent a colder winter than a summer in San Francisco, is still true. I love it. That's why I moved here originally, the fog. I used to come out from here in the summers. I would love nothing better than putting on an overcoat, a scarf, a hat, and marching around downtown and seeing the shivering Swedes in shorts who thought they were going to Mexico, looking in guidebooks like they thought they took the wrong plane. Then last week when I was off those few days recuperating, I went around down to Union Square. I loved it, the coat, the scarf, the hat. I'm dressed for the summer here. I love it, cold. And there they were, the French, the shivering French, the shivering Germans, the shivering Swedes. So I saw three young guys. They looked Germanic. Nice-looking boys, like 16, like almost like models from a magazine. Good-looking kids, like 16. I saw they were staring at a map, lost. They were staring at on a map on California Street. So I'm like one of those guys who always tries to help people in the street. I'm from another universe. I hold doors for women. I went up to them and I said, can I help you? They looked like I was crazy because no one offered them any. They said, yeah, sure, sure. So he said, where is Union Square? So I said, do you speak German? He said, no, Swedish. So I said, okay, take the map. Here's where you're standing. Turn it around. I had to show it to them geographically and point like I was in the woods because I'm a boater. I had to do like a compass reading. I said, you're here. This is California Street. Now forget the map. I said, just head in that direction. You know, go up two blocks, go over two blocks, go up two blocks, and go over three blocks, and you'll be there. You know, they understood that, what I need a map for. Nice kids. But as I walked to Union Square in my overcoat and scarf and wool hat, my ski hat, no less, and the wind is blowing and howling, I see the girls with their hands over their bosoms, shivering with their knees together, knocking in the street with the parents. And I observe tourists. I love to see people. I happen to like crowds because I don't live around crowds. I have an apartment in San Francisco, and I have a number of dwellings in the surrounding communities, and I move around quite a bit. Sometimes I like a quiet night out in the sticks. Sometimes I like to be in the city, whatever. And I sometimes have to revert to my New York origins and get lost in a crowd, and I like to be alone. I love to walk in a crowd and get lost. It's one of my favorite occupations. You say to me, what do you really like to do? I like to get lost in a crowd and look at people. So I go around and this and that, and I observe different tourists and different people. So you see, it's still stereotypically true. The Germans are stoic and, very, very, they're stoic, not laughing. The French, I don't know, kind of snooty to themselves, even amongst themselves, with their sophistication in their own mind, sophistication based on what I don't know. And the Italians are happy and laughing. You see the 14-year-old girls with their parents. Nice kids, smiling, happy, laughing. And I reminded of what an Italian friend said to me. He said, Italians are happy Jews. I'll never forget that one. That was a great line. I loved it. I thought that was the funniest thing I ever heard. He said, Mike, he said, Italians and Jews are similar. He said, but Italians are happy Jews. I thought that was the funniest thing because a lot of Italians look like Jews and Jews look like Italians. I thought that was funny. Then I have another Italian friend who says to me, Christian, Jewish. He says, how do you put it? He says, different a division, same a corporation. I love that one. I thought that was good. Now, that's what you call interreligious communication. That's what happens when people live together and they don't throw bombs in the other one's house. You know what I'm saying? The Christians live next to the Jews now, 100 years in this country or more, and they don't put bombs in the other person's house of worship. Somehow they don't put a bomb in the gas tanks at JFK in the name of their religion. Somehow they've learned to get along, despite the centuries of enmity. That's the beauty of America. Now you have a whole group that comes here. Somehow they haven't learned to get along with everybody else. How's that possible? And to make matters worse, they got to build a mosque now at Ground Zero, and they call it cultural sensitivity to stick it right in your eye. And they wonder why people are antagonized. Let me tell you something. If they don't know why that's antagonistic, it shows you what the problem is. If the Muslims behind the Ground Zero mosque do not understand why this is seen as an antagonistic act, that is the problem itself, is because they're insensitive to everybody around them except their own kind. Now, you could write that one down. Mark it down. Put it in bronze.
Savage.
In a minute, I'm going to read you what are the 100 worst stimulus projects and where your money went down the toilet. A report was issued today by Senators Tom Coburn and John McCain, and there are 100 projects that your money funded for Nancy Pelosi's friends. Monkeys on cocaine, new windows for a closed visitor center, modern dance is a tool for software development. You'll hear more about them on the Savage Nation. You'll see what the stimulus plan was. It was Greece, in other words. It was Greece for the corrupt, is what most of it went to, as you figure. Now, you could argue that the money trickles down. I'm not so sure. I call it trickle-up poverty. And that's the title of my new book, which will be out in October. I don't want to get ahead of myself. It's on number 37,000 on Amazon, I think, right now, for pre-orders. But you want to look at it. You see the cover. You see the title, trickle-up poverty. It's an attack on the middle class. The only people benefiting are the very rich, the people who put Obama in power. Nobody said it more cleanly than I did. I'm a master at phraseology, particularly because it's true. Because Hemingway said, if it wasn't Hemingway who said, well, he said in a, Hemingway wrote, and I was a big, big fan and student of Hemingway's writings when I was trying to learn how to write when I was 18 years old, that the truth has a certain ring to it, and there's no way to define it. People know what it is. So when I say trickle-up poverty, bingo, it has a certain ring to it. That's all there is to it. So you can go and you can order it on Amazon. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. It's number 37,000 on the bestseller list because it hasn't come out. It'll be out in October. So what do you want to talk about in the Savage Nation? We got plenty of news stories out there, plenty of news stories. My first day back in almost a week, I went out with a sudden down. Like out of nowhere, boom, you think you're doing good, and all of a sudden, bang. That's the way life is. I don't know what it was. I think it was oysters I ate out in Point Reyes, truthfully. Marshall, really. I was at a joint I went to years ago, so I went back. One of my children was up. We wanted a nostalgia job. I hate oysters to begin with. It's disgusting. They make me sick looking at them. I'm never eating a hard shell. I'm never eating a hard shell shellfish again as long as I live. I may cheat and have a shrimp, but I don't even like them anymore. It's not like I'm sitting there. What do you think the Bible had prohibitions against certain foods? You think they're all crazy? There was a reason they said don't eat shellfish. Now, it's true. Yeah, the red tide. And in those days, there was no preservation and this and that. But still, in all, people get knocked on their behinds from shellfish today. I also know that it's the natural Viagra. We all know that, and it tastes good. So, you know, do what you want. What's interesting, though, is I had the oysters. And two other people in my family had the oysters. They didn't get sick. I did. And I figured out why. It's because there are different sensitivities to various microorganisms in different people. And apparently I was on the low side. I'd come through 3 months of allergies, and I think my immune system was a little down. And whatever they were able to tolerate and get rid of and kick out, I didn't kick out. I got knocked out instead of kicking it out. So I thought I had some illness like colitis. It was awful. It was awful. But here I am. So now let's talk about food, drink, eat well and drink for tomorrow may never come. What do you do when Michael Savage is not on the air? How do you feel? How are you? What are you doing? What are you saying? What do you want to do? What do you want to say? I have an essay on my a monologue on MichaelSavage.com called The Judges Save the People. The California Supreme Court last night rejected affirmative action. And so you should read it. That's all. It's an important little motto. What do you want to talk about? There's a lot of news story. The mosque thing. A lot of stuff. Modesto, Cindy, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello. I just want to know what a gefilte fish is.
Well, a gefilte fish is Robert Gibbs. He is the press secretary for Obama. That's what a gefilte fish is. But if you want to know what gefilte fish is, that's another story.
Okay. Will you tell it?
In other words, why do I call Robert Gibbs a human gefilte fish, right?
Right.
Okay, here's the answer. If you go to a supermarket and you look in the ethnic food section and you go to Jewish foods and you see jarred fish like manischewitz, it says gefilte fish, you go and look at it today, you'll see. It's a sort of, it's like a round oblong object of fish that's been rolled together. Now, imagine putting two eyes inside that fish. You'll see Robert Gibbs inside the bottle. But in all seriousness, you're asking what is gefilte fish per se, correct?
Yeah. Well, I always hear
the Jewish people originally made gefilte fish. It's a boiled fish, by the way. And they made it from the poorest fish that they get, the cheapest form of fish that was available in the Europe at that time. It was made from carp and pike and whitefish, and they mashed it up. They mixed it up together in a ball. They rolled it by hand and they boiled it, you know, with certain spices and whatnot. But it was the cheapest fish that they had. It was not an expensive dish. It was a peasant dish. It's very much in many ways like a lot of Italian people or Chinese people eat tripe, which is a poor man's food, but they came to love it. Even wealthy people will still eat some of the traditional dishes like tripa. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, so what is your ethnic background?
My ethnic background? My grandparents, or one of them was Czechoslovakian.
So if I asked you what an ethnic food is in your from your people, what would you say?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, no, most Americans are disconnected from their ethnic background. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. But in essence, that's what gefilte fish is. Not to be confused with a gefilte fish known as Robert Gibbs. New York City, WOR. Rich, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Hey, Mike. This is Rich from Brooklyn. Missed the heck out of you not being on last week. Hope you're feeling better.
Yep, I am. Thank God I'm feeling great. I prayed a lot. I asked God for a second another lease on life. Not a second, it's like the ninth.
Yeah, the radio airwaves were very lonely without you.
That's very nice to hear.
There's
a guy on a competitive station in New York who fakes it. He's a lawyer. His voice sounds like a woman getting a hysterectomy without anesthesia. You know who I'm talking about.
I think so.
Yeah. Anytime you hear a woman screaming like she's in an operating room without the anesthesia, you'll know you're listening to the other station. Thanks for the call. Hawaii Steve, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, good to have you back. I'm glad you're feeling a lot better.
Thank you. Hey, listen, thank you. I have the best listeners in America. I have the real men, the real women, the real Americans. I know that.
Figure out a way to give us some warning when you're going to take some time off to help us buffer the shock of not hearing your voice when we turn the station on. I'm stuck in the middle of the Pacific Ocean surrounded by liberals and water. You're the only connection I have between the sanity and insanity.
You've got a wonderful voice. I'm gonna try and figure this out. Were you in broadcasting ever, Steve?
Oh yes, I was. As a matter of fact,
yeah, I can tell. You have a clear broadcaster's voice. Did you retire in the islands?
Yes, sir.
Were you in the military?
I was in the Marine Corps. I was a captain.
Ah,
in the Marine Corps.
So that's already 3 out of 2. You already won the prize. Marine Corps, former broadcaster, how much more can I get out of this call?
Well, thanks for telling America exactly how I feel.
Okay, Steve, God bless you. Thanks for listening. Every listener who loves this show, you know what I'm saying? You're like bright stars on a tapestry of my mind. I don't know how to put it. I don't want to get too emotional about it, but this is a very symbiotic business. After a certain number of years, when you have an audience, and they like you, you like them. It's very much like going into a cafe with them. I used to have a shtick on my show years ago. I had a local show when I started calling Cafe Savage. Someone will rip it off tomorrow, but they can't do it, so I don't care. You can imitate someone, but you can't duplicate it, so it doesn't matter what they steal. Everyone tries the New York voice. No, they all try to act like they're a truck driver. They wonder why people don't take them seriously. You can't fake it. I'm a man of the people and a man of the streets with a high education, with a great deal of experience. So they don't need the New York street thing in order, you know. But if you go on the, hey, Uncle Jay, how you doing? You know how many guys send tapes in like that to my syndicator? They think that's going to get them on the radio. Hey, how you doing, Mickey? Blah, 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 blah. That's not what radio's about. That's not it. That's only the thing. That's only the thing. It's not the whole thing. And nothing, you know, that's not there. So anyhow, here we are. Beautiful world. So the sky is still technicolor. The fog is still thick in San Francisco. The German tourists are still shivering in the streets of the city. I am still here with Teddy, about to continue the show for quite a while yet, after which I'll be walking in the streets of San Francisco with my hat pulled down and my collar pulled up. Why would you want to live anywhere else? Why do I care about the liberal nuts here? They don't bother me. As far as I'm concerned, they're just fodder. The Wall Street Journal wrote an article about me last, a terrible piece of junk. The writer, you know, should be embarrassed. The kid had no capacity as a journalist, nothing. That's what they hired today. I mean, I've had good interviews. The New Yorker was superb. The Playboy article, although it was attempted to be a hit piece, was well written. The guy went after me at every turn. He tried to trap me and couldn't. He fired every bullet in his arsenal, every arrow in his quiver. He tried, and none of them hit me. But it was good. It was a good interview because I enjoyed the challenge. It had depth. This thing from the Wall Street Journal was a joke. You know, the guy, to show you what a poor journalist he was, he writes, oh, he writes in all caps. His emails, he writes in all caps. What's that, an attempt to say I'm illiterate because I use all caps? Yes, I use all caps in my emails. You know why? Because to me, an email to this day is still a telegram. Okay? I know how to write books, schmuck. I'm the author of 25 books. I'm not a journalist for the Wall Street Journal who got the job because they had to, you know, fill certain quotas, to be very honest with you. What a stupid article the guy writes. But in the article, he says, he asks me a question, which thank God he got this right. And he says, I asked Savage why he lives in such a liberal area, such as San Francisco. How come he lives here? So I said to him, they asked the same thing of Voltaire, why he lived in Paris if he found the foibles of the Parisians so bothersome. Why did he stay in Paris? And he said, because that's what I write about. In other words, I write about the foibles of the Parisians. So I said, that's the reason I stay in San Francisco. What could be better? Where do you want me to live? Where normal people are? What would I have to write about if I lived around normal Americans who love God and country and family? I have nothing to write about. You get it? That's why I live around here. I love this wacko area. So the air, you know, I haven't been banned from San Francisco yet. I mean, I'm still allowed here with the wonderful dental care and the food. There is good food here. I got to tell you something. It is a food city. You got to know where to go, though. You got to stay out of the downtown. Oh, the dog's already here stretching. He knows it's into the home stretch at this hour. How do they know these things? Is it my body motion? Do I give off a certain chemical? He already got up from under the desk. He's giving the four-legged stretch. Looking at me already. He thinks he's going to get the bone for the job he did already, guarding my feet from the imaginary attack. Teddy, you did such a good job. Why do people like to hear about Teddy in the studio? I don't understand it. My dog is like one enzyme away from being a man, a human. There's certain dogs that are so smart, you could almost see them reaching to become like Pinocchio, become a person. It's almost painful to watch. They look at you like they understand every word. Well, I know that he has a larger vocabulary than the average rap star. That I know. I know the dog understands at least 250 words of English. That I can guarantee you. While most of the rap artists use about 30 to 40 words. I don't care if they make $30 million. It doesn't matter to me. It means nothing to me what how much money they make. Their vocabulary is about 50 words. F-word, B-word, F-word, B-word. Varieties of the F-word, varieties of the B-word, varieties of the B and the F-word together, varieties of the F and B-word together, and they make $30 million a year. Good luck to them. Good luck to them. My dog understands about 250 words of English. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Extra, hear all about it. The judges in California saved the people last night, ruling against the city of San Francisco and against Moonbeam Brown. And they said that affirmative action is illegal and it must end in California. You see, Attorney General Moonbeam Brown tried to overturn Prop 209. He wanted to discriminate against white contractors. He wanted to keep set-asides for women and minorities. And he and Gavin Newsom, Annie Tussum Newsom, and their far-left stooges tried to do this all over again. The judges said no. So don't think that it's all a lost cause. This is a huge loss for the left-wing cabal in San Francisco and in California, believe me. And you have to understand it's all not dark. It really isn't. San Francisco, Lance, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to discuss why I think people find that Teddy is so popular out here in the Savage Nation. I think it's because, of course, you're a political independent. I think you're personally independent, but you are not independent of that dog. You have given that dog some control over your life, and this makes you very human to us out here on the other end of the radio waves.
That's very, you mean you see the vulnerability in me and that, and I have such affection for him?
Yes, quite right. And I'm curious, how did Teddy react to you when you were ill? Did he provide protection or some sort of a vibe?
He wouldn't leave the foot of my bed. They couldn't get him off the bed even to eat. For the first 2 days.
Right.
No, I'm telling you, it's awesome. You got to understand that when they say man is dog's best friend, there's something to that. The dog would not leave the foot of my bed.
And Teddy is your number one fan. So, of course, we out here in the Savage Nation.
Well, he is. He really is. If they, I'll tell you, I think he's going to be banned in England next because he could be a threat to the bulldog.
Good grief.
What if Teddy goes over there and barks about freedom of speech? It's liable to upset the English bulldog who has been neutered now with the invasion of the folks from Pakistan.
Well, don't worry,
the Pakistanis seem to be running England right now.
You have a greater independence from England than you do from the dog. It occurs to me.
Well, yeah, I'm banned in England, but I don't know if my dog could get in there. Maybe they let him in, not me. Maybe I could send him over on a surveillance mission.
Rabies issue.
I don't know. Anyway, I'm glad you listened to me, listened to the show. Thank you very much. 1-800-449-8255, Michael Savage. Let's go to Palm Beach, where the heat index is 50 degrees higher than San Francisco. Lynn, welcome. How are you dealing with the heat down there?
Oh, it's hot, but I've been staying inside.
You're sitting in the air conditioning.
Oh, yes, inside. I wanted to tell you, I'm glad you're feeling better. We did miss you, and we're a lot like Teddy, I guess. We sit at the foot of the radio.
I know. There's a deep connection between shows that have an audience that's regular. The audience and the speaker are very much connected. There's no question.
Well, you remind me of my grandfather and all.
I'm glad to hear it. That's nice. What, I have 3 days left?
I wanted to tell you.
How many days do I have before they got the box ready for me? I love when they are the grandfather. What, he lived to the ripe old age of 52?
No, my grandfather lived till 84. But he had
that's an insult to me. That's a joke. Years ago, they say that the longest living people live it. Okay, let's start from that. I used to write health books, so I remember reading about a certain group Abkhazia, wherever, some mountainous region in the Caucasus, where the people typically lived well into their hundreds, and they said it was because they ate apricots, for example. They grew the apricots. There were many other reasons that they allegedly lived that long. So if you went there and you said to them, may you live to the age of 100, they would get insulted and walk out of the room because everyone lived to 105, 110. You know what I'm saying?
We hope you live to 100 and past.
Would you want to live to 100? Let me ask you something. With Obama in office, would you want to live to 100?
Absolutely not. No.
Do you want to see what him and his communist cohorts do to this country? This great nation that is so great that even a non-entity like him could become president? Thanks for the call. I want to live to 100. I don't care whether you do or not. I do. I come from a short-lived male line, so I'm hoping that the female inheritance is very strong in me. Now, if I appear one day on the radio in lipstick and heels, you'll understand why. What can I do? But... No, look, this is, you know, the women thing is a very interesting thing. The woman element in a man, the whole concept of the female in the male in the female, is something it's really worth talking about another time. I don't have the time to go into it. But, you know, if men learn to let the genetic side of themselves, that is the female, I didn't say become metrosexual, I didn't say become soft, but, you know, playing the macho guy has its limitations. It's very caustic on your body to always have to be a hard-nosed, tough guy. Look at a leopard, whether it be a male or a female. Do you see how lithe the male leopard is? That male leopard is not overly stiff in his motions. The male leopard walks in a lithe manner the same way as the female does. Why is that? Because he's not trapped in a stereotype of how he should be. Got it?
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We'll be right back. big story today is that the California Supreme Court has rejected affirmative action once again. Now, the California Supreme Court has rejected gay marriage, and now they've rejected an attempt by Attorney General Moonbeam Gary Brown to turn the clock back 20 years and reinstate preferences in hiring and contracting for less qualified women and less qualified minorities in an attempt to pander to these groups and to shaft white males in plain English. What is interesting about this case is that it came up again. Now, why the case came up is because white contractors, white male contractors, who had been trying to fight the set-asides for women and minorities, took it to court. And Jerry Brown had tried to reinstitute these preferences. These were set-asides specifically for minority-owned and women-owned companies, which, by the way, is a total violation of the U.S. Constitution and clearly unfair. Now, I want to remind you that in California, we had a battle called Prop 209 15 years ago. It was overwhelmingly supported by the people. It banned affirmative action. And yet we have an attorney general, the highest lawyer in the state, who would be governor, who is running against Meg Whitman, Jerry Brown, who tries to turn the clock back and reintroduce preferential hiring simply to target white males. This is a great victory for fairness and a great victory for those of us that still respect the U.S. Constitution. Now, another way to look at this is that the judges have saved the people. Again, I want to reiterate, the California State Supreme Court last night ruled against the city of San Francisco and the Attorney General, Jerry Brown. The judges said that Prop 209, which was passed overwhelmingly by the voters to end racial preferences in California, means that Mayor Gavin Newsom, that's any Twosome Newsom, and his far-left stooges now have to stop discriminating against white males. Seems that the moderate judges of California came to their senses and saved the state from their far-left political class. Now, this is a huge loss for Attorney General Jerry Brown, who was trying to worm his way back into the governor's mansion after 30 years on the outside. Brown had endorsed San Francisco's argument that whites should be discriminated against. Now, anyone who thinks that Jerry Brown has become more conservative or that he has turned over a new leaf should know that he went against the will of the people of California to support out-and-out racism in this case. Brown wanted to nullify the votes of millions. But even more important than that is the fact that the moderate judges of California have for the second time saved the state from its so-called leaders. When Gavin Twosome Newsom tried to declare gay marriage legal, the California Supreme Court struck that down as well. When the people of California reinforced that ruling by voting for Prop 8, which banned gay marriage, well, the judges said they're right. Now, for the first time in ages, the courts and the people seem to be on the same side. And standing against the people are Jerry Brown, Gavin Twosome, and all the other political hustlers who exploit race and sexual orientation for their own gain, against the will of the people and against the U.S. Constitution. A real victory. The judges saved the people. It is now going up on michaelsavage.com. Now, let's see what the headlines are today that made it to my website, michaelsavage.com. It's very important that you know that there are stories that I take from other sites. Okay, Obamacare only looks worse upon further review, Bloomberg News. From the Washington Times, illegal alien who killed nun in accident was released by feds. See, Carlos Montano had been arrested two other times on drunken driving charges, and on at least one of those occasions, county police reported him to federal authorities. Ah, dead nun. Here we go. State Supreme Court upholds affirmative action ban. Two Muslims convicted for plot to blow up JFK fuel tanks. Now, of course, you will not read that they're Muslims or Muslim converts. One converted in prison. One's name was Abdul Qadir, a pistol-packing Shiite convert who wanted to blow up fuel tanks at JFK to cause a bigger explosion than 911. Now, if you think that's bad, it gets worse. Our acting Solicitor General, appointed by Obama, has denied that our battle against terrorists is a war. Neil Katyal, who became the acting U.S. Solicitor General when Elena Kagan was nominated, previously served as the legal counsel of record for the man who worked as Bin Laden's driver. He's now inside the government, working for Obama against the people. The government's been taken over. New York City panel clears way for mosque near Ground Zero. You hear this? People are saying you can build a mosque at Ground Zero when we can build a synagogue in Mecca. That's when elephants fly. I'll be right back.
Savage.
When you feel as if every single initiative that we're doing is subject to Washington politics instead of, is this good for the country, that can be frustrating. But having said that, look, there are legitimate differences to be had between the parties, and a lot of this criticism I try to listen to, and if I think it's fair, then we try to correct it. Now, some of it I tend not to think is fair, and Michelle doesn't think any of it's fair.
In his weekly report on the shenanigans of the left coast, here is James Hersey.
We've all heard that President Obama appeared on The View. It was his third time on that show. Now, as president, Obama is the honorary chairman of the Boy Scouts of America. He was scheduled to speak to that wonderful American institution on the same day he taped The View, but he stiffed the scouts to go on a mindless daytime talk show and then do fundraisers hitting up fat cat donors. Right after the taping, Obama hit not one, but two $30,000 per person fundraisers in Manhattan for the Democratic National Committee, including one at the fancy residence of Vogue editor Anna Wintour.
Well, who's that?
She's the woman who inspired Meryl Streep's mean character in The Devil Wears Prada. Who would have imagined, at a time when soldiers, sailors, and Marines are dying, citizens are out of work, the nation is spiraling into bankruptcy, the borders are wide open, that they would have four Marine helicopters, a battalion of police, and Secret Service agents mobilized so Obama could hang out with Barbara Walters, Whoopi Goldberg, Joy Behar, and company? You know, President Obama said he'd bring change. He'd bring change to the White House. Well, he certainly has. First president to intentionally use the phrase looking for some A to kick. First president to appear on a late night show while in office, appearing as a celebrity. First president to go on a prime time comedy show while in office. And now the first president sitting on the couch at a daytime chat show. He's changed the presidency, all right. Lowered the stature and the dignity of that office. But Obama defenders squeal. He's not the only one, they say. Other presidents have appeared on television. Not like this.
Exactly.
Dwight Eisenhower appeared on a variety show called Producers Showcase in the 50s and on the Colgate Comedy Hour, but he did it to kick off Armed Forces Week. In 1958, Eisenhower made a pre-filmed appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, but he was appealing for charity, contributions to the United Fund. John F. Kennedy appeared on Jack Parr's Tonight Show, but he was a candidate in 1960, not a president in the White House. And Richard Nixon had a cameo on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, but it was as a candidate in 1968, and he only spoke one line, the show's trademark slogan, "Sock it to me." And that was pretty funny. Gerald Ford, after being skewered regularly by Saturday Night Live, taped a couple of cameo spots that made fun of himself. Bill Clinton, as we remember, played his saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show, but again, at the time, Clinton was a candidate. Not the president. Incidentally, the show was canceled shortly after Clinton was elected.
Ha ha.
And George and Laura Bush once appeared on the Dr. Phil show in 2004. They appeared to talk about families. And the appearance was taped at Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. And then it was played on the Dr. Phil show. The president didn't show up at Dr. Phil's studio. So why would Obama become a regular guest on The View while in office? Well, Obama and his handlers obviously wanted a safe, easy venue where the president could be a star, not have to deal with serious questions, and could attempt to charm a predominantly female audience. I mean, what kind of questions was he asked? Well, he was asked questions about Lindsay Lohan, about Mel Gibson, about a reality show star, and about Chelsea Clinton's wedding. I mean, clearly, this kind of an appearance weakens the seriousness of the office of the president. It lowers the stature of the leader of the free world's ability to appear to be fully in charge of the important issues before the nation. And a Pennsylvania Democratic governor, Ed Rendell, agrees. He likened The View to the Jerry Springer show, and he said appearing on that show is beneath the dignity of the presidency. Even Rosie O'Donnell, who used to be a host on that show, criticized Obama for going on The View.
Really?
On her satellite radio show, O'Donnell said she had mixed feelings about it. Quote, "I don't really think sitting presidents should go do fluffy daytime TV shows," she said. "Maybe an hour on Oprah or something," Rosie added. "I don't really want to see him on The View, I gotta tell you," she said. She mentioned the fact that Barbara Walters came back that day after her heart surgery. I mean, having Obama as a guest was reason enough for Barbara Wawa to return to the show for the first time since she had the surgery. Obama also used The View to pass the buck, especially in answer to a question about Shirley Sherrod, you know, the agricultural official who was forced to resign last week by the Obama administration, essentially fired because of that video that was posted that was admittedly incomplete. Sherry Shepherd, one of The View co-hosts, brought up the Sherrod case. And she ended her question by asking Obama, "Do you think America is still racist?" But the president didn't answer the question. Instead, he reminded the audience he had talked with Sherrod, adding that she's a wonderful woman. But then he blamed everything. The firing of Sherrod, you know, the firing that she says came from the White House. He blamed it all on the media.
Well, of course.
He said the problem is that we now live in a 24/7 media culture that is always looking for controversy and doesn't always get to the facts first. And the lesson he said he wanted to draw was, let's get the facts straight before we act. Now, there's a novel idea for the Obama administration. Joy Behar contributed her usual vapid questioning. She asked a leading question talking about what she called the right, which she defined as Fox News and other outlets. And she said that this right seems to be controlling the narrative of the Obama presidency. And Behar angrily asked, "Where is your attack dog?" So Obama kind of quipped back. He said, "That's your job." And he got a big laugh from the audience because sometimes the truth is funny. Obama admitted that he wasn't invited to the wedding of Chelsea Clinton. And this has been the biggest headline in the media because it shows how deep the rift is for real between the Clintons and the Obamas. But then the New Jersey Shore bombshell. When the name of reality star Snooki was brought up, Obama said, "I'm sorry, I don't know who that is."
Well, why is that important?
Well, he was either lying or he doesn't remember, but it wasn't that long ago. The president used Snooki as a punchline at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Obama told this joke. He said, well, the next provision is called the Jersey Shore Up. It reads, the following individuals shall be excluded from the indoor tanning tax within this bill: Snooki, JWoww, The Situation, and House Minority Leader John Boehner. The president loves to make fun of John Boehner's tan. But this may be a watershed moment for Obama. When we look at today's culture, Obama's credibility may take a major hit when the public sees and hears him in contrasting videos being sneaky about Snooki.
Hmm. Thanks for the report, James.
Thanks, Michael, for giving the audience of the Savage Nation relevant views. Back to you, my friend.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
Joining us now with an exclusive Savage Nation report is Eric Stackelbeck.
Michael, always great to be here. Well, this week we have two more cases of a never-ending series, it seems like, of homegrown jihad. Now, just a few days ago, the arrests were announced of two homegrown jihadists. One in Northern Virginia, a guy by the name of Zachary Chesser. Now, his Islamic name is Abu Talah al-Amriki. He was the first one arrested. Then we had a guy by the name of Paul Rockwood, who lived in Alaska, of all places. You won't believe this story, Michael. I'll get to the Alaska story in a second. But first, I want to start with our buddy, Mr. Chesser. Now, he's a 20-year-old white kid, a white convert to Islam, living in Oakton, Virginia, which is just a few miles from D.C., a few miles from the White House. He was a former student at George Mason University, which is a very good school here in the D.C. area. He was apparently a high school athlete, pretty normal kid in high school. He graduated about 2 years ago. When he left high school, for whatever reason, he veered into not only Islam, but jihadist Islam, and he planned, according to the FBI, he planned to travel to Somalia to join a group called Al-Shabaab. Now, this group, very bad news, linked to Al-Qaeda, Michael. You might remember their name about 2 weeks ago. They were the group that carried out that horrific bombing in Uganda of killed about 70 people who were watching a World Cup match on TV. Al-Shabaab carried this attack out. There's been several Americans to leave U.S. soil and travel to Somalia to join up with this group. And this Zachary Chesser character, white convert to Islam, was looking to be the latest jihadi to link up with Al-Shabaab. And they got him at the airport, Michael. And this tells you the quality of individual this guy is. He was trying to bring his 7-month-old infant son to Somalia with him.
Oh, my God.
It might have been the world's youngest jihadist if Mr. Chesser had his way. So that tells you what we're dealing with here. Now, the thread that links Mr. Chesser with Paul Rockwell in Alaska, or Paul Rockwood in Alaska, who I'll get to in a second, is both men, Michael, were adherents, disciples of Anwar al-Awlaki. There's that name again. We've talked about Awlaki here on the show several times over the past few months. Basically, Michael, he's had a hand over the past few months in every major Islamic terrorism case in the U.S., whether it was the Fort Hood shooting, whether it was the underwear bomber on Christmas Day, the Times Square bomber. All of these men either were in direct contact with Mr. Awlaki, or they were inspired by Awlaki. Now, he's a jihadist cleric. He's based in Yemen. He's a member of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And really, according to U.S. intelligence officials I speak to, Michael, he is now the world's most influential Islamic jihadist, surpassing even Osama bin Laden. And as I've told you before, the thing that makes Mr. Awlaki so dangerous is he's fluent in English. He was born and raised in America, knows our language, knows our culture, so that makes it very easy for him to connect with young Western Muslims and converts like a Zachary Chesser, and like a Paul Rockwood in Alaska.
Unbelievable.
So moving on to Mr. Rockwood, who was another disciple of Alaki. He and Chesser, as I said, followed Alaki online, even tried to contact Chesser, at least, even tried to contact him via email, apparently had some email exchanges with him. They listened to his DVDs. They listened to his CDs. And I can tell you from being in Northern Virginia, where both of these guys spent some time, and where Alaki was the imam of a mosque, the Dar al-Hijra Mosque, just a few miles from the White House, I can tell you that Alaki is still very, very popular in that Northern Virginia area, to say the least. And his DVDs and CDs are hot sellers in the Islamic stores in Northern Virginia. Believe me on that, Michael. I've seen it firsthand. I've reported on it firsthand. But Mr. Rockwood in Alaska, now this is a very interesting case. He was a weatherman in a small Alaska town called King Salmon, Alaska. He lived in Northern Virginia for a time, as I said, around 2001, 2002, when he was still in this area. He converted to Islam, discovered Anwar al-Awlaki, and quickly became radicalized. Now, he moved to Alaska. He was married, actually, to a British woman, or he is married to a British woman, and we know Britain, obviously, is a hotbed of Islamic Jihad, but they're both white converts, but he was the weatherman, and he was able to ingratiate himself in this local community of only about 450 people.
Sure.
Now, Michael, Paul Rockwood and his wife, Nadia, pleaded guilty in a U.S. District Court in Anchorage to a count of willfully making false statements to the FBI about domestic terrorism. Now, the plea agreements say that Rockwood was an adherent of jihadist Islam. He had prepared a list of assassination targets, including U.S. service members. So this is a very dangerous guy, according to the U.S. government. But to listen to the L.A. Times, Michael, that quote-unquote piece of journalistic excellence, the L.A. Times makes this guy sound just like another persecuted victim of government Islamophobia. It's really just one of the most horrific pieces of journalism by Kim Murphy of the L.A. Times in terms of giving one side of the story completely and portraying Mr. Rockwood and his wife like persecuted victims here.
What did it say?
Listen to this, Michael. Talking about Rockwood's wife, Kim Murphy of the L.A. Times writes, "She was a stay-at-home mom who drove their four-year-old to preschool, sang in the town choir, and picked berries with her girlfriends. She took part in a community play in which she portrayed a fairy godmother and confronted the big bad wolf for his crimes against Little Red Riding Hood and the three little pigs." Then we have later in the article, "Here in King Salmon, Alaska, where the biggest thing is the annual Red Salmon Run, this has the air of a poorly written movie," basically saying the whole affair of these people's, you know, arrests. And what you have is just a litany of locals in Alaska, Michael, saying, oh, in this town in Alaska, saying that, you know, the Rockwoods would never be capable of this. We can't believe he was arrested for this. We never saw this coming. He's a great guy. Their family was a pillar of the community, yada, yada, yada. And then, of course, Murphy has to add in a local saying, "It's not uncommon in a bar here to hear some moron say," and I'm quoting from Kim Murphy's piece, "to hear some moron say, I hate Barack Obama because he's a terrorist and an Arab, and people will swear up and down that Obama is a Muslim." So people like Rockwood, for families like them, the article continues, you can imagine it'd be a little tough.
Hmm.
Now that's Kim Murphy quoting a local sympathetic to the Rockwoods. So basically this entire piece is a puff piece making the Rockwoods look like victims, which brings me to my point. Paul Rockwood and his wife, who were about to depart for Great Britain, by the way, when they were arrested. God knows who they were going to link up with in Great Britain, which is a jihadist hotbed. But here's the deal. They were able to ingratiate themselves in the local community. They were viewed as pillars of the community. Everyone loved them. And, Michael, I've seen the script before. Last August, I traveled to Raleigh, North Carolina. I investigated a major terrorism case there, an 8-man cell in Raleigh, North Carolina, in the rolling countryside near Tobacco Road in North Carolina. This cell was broken up. The leader was a guy by the name of Daniel Boyd. He was another white convert to Islam, had a history. He trained in Pakistan, Afghanistan, had fought overseas, fought jihad over there. He was another guy. He lived in a really nice development in the countryside, had a lake behind his home, beautiful rural area outside of Raleigh, North Carolina. Michael, I went down there firsthand. I interviewed all of his neighbors. They all said the same thing. He's a great guy. We love him. We love his family. He's not capable of this. We support him.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the FBI had the guy dead to rights. I mean, the indictment was so damning against Daniel Boyd and two of his sons, and they found a huge weapon stash dug out underneath his basement, and he was surveilled training in firearms in Virginia and shouting out Allahu Akbar, etc. So they had this guy squarely in their sights. But he was so persuasive in fooling his neighbors, in making them think he was a great guy and just another person in the community. And he never talked about Islam, according to his neighbors never talked about his faith. And what it all boils down to, Michael, is this. Daniel Boyd was steeped, same with Paul Rockwood up in Alaska, steeped in something called taqiyya. In Arabic, that's deception, which means you are allowed to deceive, to lie to your infidel neighbors, your infidel associates, if it furthers the cause of jihad. Now, Daniel Boyd, who I investigated in North Carolina, was obviously steeped in taqiyya, and Mr. Rockwood in Alaska, I believe, was most likely steeped in the same. He's nice to his neighbors on the outside. He's going to kids' birthday parties. He's going to the local, you know, neighborhood barbecue. But behind the scenes, in the privacy of his home, he's online, he's chatting with jihadis overseas, and he's plotting to carry out jihad. It happens so many times in these domestic terrorism cases, they're able to ingratiate themselves into the fabric of the local community, and it is taqiyya. And if there's one thing listeners take today from our interview here, Michael, taqiyya, deception. It's used time and time again by Islamic jihadists.
This is unbelievable to me.
And to get the real scoop about Daniel Boyd in North Carolina last year, I went to the local Islamic Center, the people who knew him best, not his infidel Christian neighbors, but the people who really knew him, the mosque goers. And what I found, Michael, was eye-opening. I talked to an influential Muslim in the Raleigh area who's very plugged into the Muslim community there, who told me, look, nothing in that indictment of Daniel Boyd surprises me. This guy talked about jihad all the time. He bragged about how he fought with the Mujahideen against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the late 80s. He talked about how he hated Israel, hated the U.S. military. So this Muslim, who knew him well, said none of this was a surprise. So he wore one face to his Christian neighbors, the locals, and he wore a completely other face, another mask, in front of local Muslims in the community. And I'm guessing that Paul Rockwood in Alaska and maybe Zachary Chesser in Northern Virginia did the same. So taqiyya, Michael, everyone needs to realize this. What taqiyya is, deception in Arabic. It's something that Islamic jihadists use time and time again. And unfortunately, our government elites and our mainstream media types like Kim Murphy at the LA Times have no idea what this concept is, and it's going to get us in trouble in the long run.
Thanks for the report, Eric.
Michael, thank you. Always a pleasure.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
You know, Obama is falling further and further in the eyes of the country. Even he gives himself a grade of incomplete.
Whether you like it or not, this really ends up being a referendum on you. If you had to give yourself an assessment for these first 18 months, how would you grade yourself?
It's incomplete because until the economy has rebounded fully and people are feeling better, we've got a long way to go.
The great pretender goes on about his many accomplishments.
When I look back on what we've accomplished in the last 18 months, preventing the country sinking into a Great Depression, stabilizing the financial markets, saving the U.S. auto industry, oh, and by the way, passing health care, I'd say that's a pretty good track record. But until the unemployment rate is down and the economy is where it needs to be, I'm not going to be satisfied.
But what's more maddening than what Obama's done is the fact that the Republicans go right along with him. Here is the deceitful Lindsey Graham praising Obama for our great relationship with Pakistan.
Things generally are the best they've been with Pakistan in a long time. And this is one area where President Obama doesn't get enough credit. His team have brought out the Pakistanis into the fight better than anybody in recent memory. They're cooperating with us more. They're allowing us to use these drone attacks. We're punishing the Haqqani network and Al-Qaeda that's hiding in Pakistan. The aid packages that we've given to the Pakistani army have been well used. General Kiani has been a good partner in taking the fight to the frontier regions. I would say that the Obama administration has done a very good job of taking the fight to the enemy in Pakistan and trying to bolster the Pakistanis' capability to take the fight to the enemy.
That's nuts. Our money is going to the enemy, and Pakistan is the world's largest downloader of internet pornography. And now the radical Muslims are forcing a mosque to be built at Ground Zero in New York City under the guise of freedom of religion and fairness.
Now, building a mosque right on top of it is hurtful, and religion shouldn't be hurtful. And if you want to build a relationship, do it in a way that's a little more, this is almost like a penetrative act. That's how severe this is.
The man on the street in New York is not happy with this decision. And neither is Representative Peter King, one of the few decent men in Congress.
The fact is that we have found since 9/11, a number of imams and Muslim leaders are not cooperating with law enforcement. Secondly, I remember the outrage at Auschwitz when Catholic nuns wanted to put up a convent near Auschwitz. And I'm saying, in many ways, this is the same, that you have sacred ground and you have a mosque being put up there when there's any number of other locations in the city. And that's why even such a liberal-minded group as the Anti-Defamation League has also come out against this. And that, to me, speaks volumes.
Fort Hood gunman still earns $6,000 a month, ABC News. You remember old the Muslim murderer, Major Hassan? Oh, yeah. That's right. He still gets $6,000 a month from the U.S. government. 56% of New York State voters favor the repeal of Obamacare. Congress is planning another bank bailout. China to pass Japan as the world's number two economic superpower. If you missed the interview of Michael Savage in Playboy, it's now permanently up with a very good-looking bunny on michaelsavage.com. michaelsavage.com, sorry. And we also have the article. Where is it? We have the Playboy article. Oh, the New Yorker profile is permanently up on Michael Savage, too. Again, Healing Children Naturally can only be ordered on michaelsavage.com, written by a parent and I'm the author of 17 health books. That's me. A to Z Natural Approaches for Natural Complaints. If you have a child or a grandchild, you really must get a copy of Healing Children Naturally. There are many other stories. Oh, here's one you don't want to miss. My headline, Sound Man Buys Deaf News Week for $1. What do I mean by Sound Man? Well, Sidney Harmon of Harmon Kardon, the husband of Jane Harmon, super left-wing member of Congress, paid $1 to buy Newsweek. And the reason he paid $1 to buy Newsweek is because no one reads it anymore. And the reason he got it for a dollar is he inherited several hundred million dollars in debt. And so my website has more traffic than Newsweek, if you can believe it. My radio show has more traffic than Newsweek, if you can believe it. My radio show has more traffic than the Washington Post, I believe. Don't underestimate the power of the press. This is Michael Savage. I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today. And if you look at the world economy and you see the number of consumers in China and the number of Buicks they're selling in China compared to the number of Buicks they're selling in Brooklyn, you understand where this country has gone. In years past, your grandfather would have bought a Buick. Whether it was the Buick Roadmaster, if he was near a Rockefeller, he got a Roadmaster. If he was a Rockefeller in Brooklyn, he bought a Cadillac, and if he was really a rich one, he went from the 62 to the 82 to the Fleetwood. But today, those days are gone. He doesn't buy the Buick anymore. It's the guy who came out of Tibet, and he's gone from a Paddy to a Caddy in virtually one generation. That's the new buyer for General Motors, from a Paddy to a caddy in one generation.
All the stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now.
A Savage Injustice in Britain, you must read it. That's right, it's an important story, actually, that you shouldn't ignore, because it has something to do with Winston Churchill. A Savage Injustice in Britain is a story you think you know about, but what you don't know is that although I have been banned in Britain, and it's a very important story, because between 1928 and 1938, Sir Winston Churchill claimed that he was virtually banned from the BBC, because according to Churchill, the British government did not want to offend the sensibilities of the German people. Sound familiar? Had Churchill's voice been allowed to create vigorous debate at that time, there might not have been a World War II, or there might not have been a Holocaust. But you see, the socialists prevailed, and Churchill was banned from speaking on the BBC.